Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis Hornsby, and today we'll talk about smart student loan moves to make starting in 2024. But first, we're going to listen to some listener questions. It's been a little while since we opened the voicemail box, and so I thought we'd listen to a couple. And the first one is a wonderful way to start a podcast. It's a little bit humorous. So let's listen to the first listener voicemail.
Hey, Travis. It's Andrew. Hey, longtime listener. Just want to thank you for all that you do. Just wanted to let you know that I am on hold with Nelnet, and it's been 3 hours and 1 minute and 44 seconds. And let me tell you, I got all their hold music on repeat, and I am jamming out. Talk to you later. Thanks for all you do again. Bye.
What a positive attitude to have after being on hold for 3 hours and 50 minutes or whatever it was. That is just really terrible. I think I would not be that patient. It sounds like somebody that might have an iPhone too, because I feel like Android, I feel like when I used to have an Android, it used to be on hold like with airlines for like 2 hours or something. It did a great job managing the hold. But then like for whatever reason, I feel like iPhone's worse than that. So you actually have to sit on there. I don't know if that's true or not, but like, golly, what a positive attitude. Pure kudos. A lot of people listening today just listened to that and just felt that down to their bones. So thanks for sharing. Let's now listen into the second listener question.
Hi, my wife and I consolidated her loans that were part of PSLF in order to take advantage of the IDR account adjustment waiver so that her loans of different lengths and repayment could all have the higher amount. In the process of doing that, we were put onto the save plan, but then Mohila messed up and put her back onto an income contingent repayment plan, which jumped her payment from $480 to $740. They acknowledged that this was their mistake, and we had to resubmit the save plan application. Now they have placed us in administrative forbearance because it is taking them too long to get her paperwork processed. They said when we called them to ask about it that we do not have to make payments in October, and that the time that we spend in this administrative forbearance, since it could take up to 90 days, will still count towards her PSLF payment count. We were just wondering if you have any insight into people being placed on administrative forbearance because of a delay in paperwork processing, and then how that affects PSLF. After this is all done, my wife should have 10 to 11 more months of repayment, and we don't want to delay being able to have it forgiven any longer than it needs to be. Thank you.
So the good news is, I just want to reconfirm for everybody, administrative forbearance does count for PSLF and IDR. You're also supposed to get retroactive 0% interest during this period of administrative forbearance, and you can even ask for a refund of payments made since being placed into an administrative forbearance. So if you made a payment of any kind, in this case, the listener said about $700 or so, you can get that money back in your pocket and it still counts. Again, you know, what I hope is listening to this pod literally puts money back in your pocket. And a lot of people that did have money come out of their accounts during the administrative forbearance period that are going for forgiveness could get that money refunded, but you only have a little bit of time to do that. So you want to go ahead and reach out to your servicer if you made payments during this administrative forbearance period, which it really, honestly, the more people I reach out to and listen to, it really feels like the majority of people might have been put in administrative forbearance since October. So if that's you, definitely get your money back in your pocket where it belongs. Let's listen to another one.
Hey there. I just have a couple questions about income recertification as well as PSLF that hopefully other people are wondering too. The first part is when I finished college in 2017, started paying mid-2017. At that time, I didn't know anything about income plans, but when I actually hit that 6 months of pay, I wasn't even employed. I was doing the 10-year. It was way, just really, really hard. So then come February or March, I applied for income plan. It was determined that my payment should be $0 because I made so little money the previous year. Big lifesaver. And ever since then, I have also qualified for $0 payments. The thing is that my previous year tax returns, so the 2018 that my 2019 $0 payment was based off of, really is not reflective of what I made in 2019. I made a lot of money that year after finally securing a well-paying job. and going into whenever my next recertification is, I took medical leave for this year, so my income is going to reflect that, which is lower than my yearly salary to begin with, and I'm a postal worker, we're expecting a significant raise. So it's really not going to be reflective of how much I make in any way, but it's going to give me a low payment. So firstly, I just wanted to check that, you know, this might be an ethical gray area, but it's not a legal one. Just to check, maybe I shouldn't be saying this out loud. I feel no personal ethical dilemma about not doing that. The second thing is all the jobs I've had have qualified for PSLF. So at this point, with my breaks in employment, I have about 5.5 years towards it. And so my question is, you know, we talk about the SAFE plan potentially being in trouble with a new president. Kind of wondering how protective and conservative I should be about considering if PSLF would be removed or canceled. So I'm going to have these low payments, and my, you know, personal objective is to pay as little as possible because I'm going to get my loans forgiven, which fortunately aren't enormous. I owe about $27,000. But if I'm worried about the PSLF being canceled, should I be making payments beyond my payment determined for the SAFE plan, like pay extra since I can afford to, just in case PSLF goes away? Obviously, this will be pretty dependent on the next election, and I would imagine if Biden wins in 2024, I should be secure because I'll be forgiven by the time he's out of office. But if we were to have a Republican president, would it be in my best interest to kind of defensively pay extra, or should I stick to the mentality of it's all going to get forgiven, just give them as little money as possible? So just want to make sure I'm making the right call, both that, you know, I'm not going to get in trouble for my income plan being based on a pretty inaccurate income, and also checking that paying as little as possible is the correct mentality, at least right now. So, yep, really, really appreciate you guys' podcast. It has decreased so much stress for me, and hopefully you guys can answer this and just give me the final bit of peace that I need going into these repayments. So, thanks, guys.
So a couple thoughts on this one. We'll keep this person anonymous just because of the information shared. You know, in terms of keeping your payment low, there's just tons of stuff that you can do totally legally to keep your payment low where, you know, you don't even have to wonder if it's correct or not. For example, let's just say that you recertify your income with a really low pay stub because you have sort of a volatile job or something. You constantly are doing this to avoid paying on your full taxable income, right? Like, so for example, let's say you're like a sales executive or something like that, and your paychecks can really vary a ton, and you just present a low pay stub every time you have the opportunity to get a lower payment. That's not allowed. It doesn't mean that you're going to get caught, but it's also against the rules. The best thing to do is just to give people your, in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, you just want to have your tax return so there's no, you know, eventually they're going to audit this, right? Eventually they're going to start coming up with a program to audit. I'll tell you probably how it'll go. They'll probably come out with some, Wall Street Journal is probably going to be the paper that'll do it. Wall Street Journal will come out with some sort of scathing report, like GAO finds that only 20% of borrowers paid actually 10% of their income or something like that. And it's not going to happen until like there's just massive amounts of money being forgiven under this program. We're still kind of early in that. But as the PSLF program becomes more ingrained and grows, eventually you'll have some sort of like, you know, negative headline, right? And then if there's Republicans in charge, they're probably going to push for money to audit people getting forgiveness. And this is like way down the line, right? But this is something that could happen. Doesn't necessarily mean that it will happen. The way to protect yourself is just do the very above the board stuff, and then you don't have to worry. And then, by the way, there are gray areas, right? Like if you're making, you know, if you're in a community property state and your taxable income doesn't reflect your current income because, you know, half of your total household income is not the same thing as yours, and you want to let the servicer know that. To me, that's an area that we think is fine to make sure that you're using alternative documentation. But, you know, we get questions all the time from practice owners that are like, can I just submit like my really low W-2 statement, you know, and not report any of my K-1 income for my profit distribution to get lower IDR payments? You can do anything, right? Just how like you can go fudge the numbers on your income taxes. And then the question is will you be caught? So the answer is you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to clearly report all taxable income that you make, and the servicer gets to calculate your payment. And if your income falls for any reason on a sort of more permanent type of basis for an indeterminate period of time, let's say, then you can call and get your, or go online to studentaid.gov/IDR and get your payment recalculated. So that would be the advice that I would give to this person in this situation is, first of all, PSLF is pretty safe. You don't really have to worry about PSLF going away. The question about the save plan going away should not induce you to make extra payments, right? Like, you definitely have to worry about tomorrow. And so we should wait until after the 2024 election and then determine who's the winner of that election and then determine what they think about student loans. You know, to be real honest, if it is Biden versus Trump, right, the best indication of what, you know, Trump would do about student loans if he were to win is what he did during his presidency, which is basically nothing. I mean, if you recall, Trump was the one that started the payment and interest pause. That's kind of an interesting thing to think about, where save plan actually might not go away if you have a President Trump, depending on who exactly is advising him on education policy. And with Biden, obviously, save would, of course, stick around and continue to benefit people. Let's listen to another one.
Hi, Travis. My name is Brandon. I love the show. I do have a lot of student loans, about $300K, just slightly over that. I currently have three loans. I have a set of loans I had consolidated about a year ago, and I went back to graduate school in 2021 and then dropped out in 2023. So with that extra schooling, I have two additional federal loans. I'm on the save plan. I will have the start my payments sometime this month. My question is, would it make sense to consolidate all three loans into one loan? The reason why I ask is because for forgiveness when I get it in a few years, I was wondering if the student loans, I only get the portion forgiven that those loans I consolidated about a year ago versus the new student loans that I took up this past couple of years. So basically, combine all three loans into one loan, when I still get the student loan forgiveness. Also, I did make previous payments on my first set of loans prior to the pandemic, and so I'm wondering if those will qualify. So my main question would, by me qualifying, by me consolidating all three loans, would that then turn into one loan, which would then include my previous payments, and therefore so keep me on track to have my loans forgiven after my 10-year period ends? Thanks so much. Looking forward to your answer. Have a great day.
So this really kind of shows what I'm concerned about after the IDR waiver. Yes, you should consolidate if you have different payments across different periods of time, right? So you should definitely do that. And you'll get credit based off the loan that has the most number of credits if you do it by December 31st. If you do it after, then it's going to be based off of basically your weighted average of credits. So that's really not nearly as good if you're a graduate borrower, because, you know, let's pretend you went to med school, right? And before med school, you did Teach for America, and you have $20K of loans from undergrad that you paid on for 2 years. And then you go back to med school and borrow $200K for med school. The weighted average method would still give you credit for those old loans, but it would be weighted. So 10% times 2 years plus 90% times 0 years on a consolidation there would equal, you know, 2 months of payment or something like that. So yes, you should consolidate if you are able to do it before December 31st. If you're not able to do it by December 31st, then you have to decide, do I want to consolidate and have a weighted average credit? And is that beneficial? Or should I not? I'm anticipating, like, a lot of our consults for 2024 are going to be very heavily into, like, what is my weighted average? What will it be after I get my consolidation happening? What should my payment count tracker be when they eventually post that on Student Aid? So that's going to be a pretty big deal, I think, for a lot of borrowers. A lot of people are unfortunately not going to realize what this caller realized. Who knows? Maybe if Biden wins, maybe he comes up with some sort of way to extend this treatment too, just to help people that missed it, right?
Hello, everyone. I have a question about the save plan and using the married filing separately method to lower my wife and I's monthly payments. We have a child and we contribute to a dependent care FSA under my wife's employer's benefits. We have put the maximum allowable $5,000 in that dependent care FSA for 2023. Would my wife and I be blocked from filing separately for 2023 since all of the $5,000 is under my wife's benefits and none is under mine, since the maximum amount would be $2,500 if we were filing separately? Or is there a way around this?
Yay for married filing separately questions. There are a couple, like, kid-dependent credits that you lose when you file taxes separately. So for this particular listener calling in, you lose you basically your dependent care FSA deduction or, you know, amount you can contribute when you file separate is cut in half. So it'd go from 5,000 to 2,500. And effectively what that does is you lose the deduction on $2,500 worth of stuff that you could have offset your income. So if it goes down from 5,000 to 2,500, 2,500 is the loss deduction amount. And that's, if you use a 40% tax rate, that's about $1,000 of a cost. We have a vastly improved calculator we're using now for student loan consults where we can see, you know, what someone's impact probably is if they file separately for taxes. And so this person, you know, maybe you get hit with $1,000 lost money from filing separate because of the dependent care FSA. Yeah, that's not great, but probably your student loan payment is lower by a lot more than $1,000 a year. So that's the way I would look at that one. And this is something that our tax team is busy helping people figure out now. We do have a tax team that can help folks. So slpwealth.com/tax, I think, is the link for that. But let's listen to one more.
Hey, SLP team. Thanks for the podcast. I teach part-time at a dental residency with a high tuition and no stipend. Most residents have debt from dental school and have zero income throughout their residency. I've heard some strategies of applying for certain federal repayment programs to get the dental school debt interest subsidized, but I've never been certain. Are there any tricks or strategies that residents can utilize now to minimize their debt burden in the future? Thanks.
So I would really love it if somebody would try out this strategy. So specifically to try out the strategy, I think your ideal person would be like in a dental residency program, or they would be like a medical student or a dental student or maybe a law student. Like those are probably the best, and maybe vet student too. Those are probably the best applications of this. I say that because those professions tend to borrow a lot of grad plus where it's really noticeable. And those folks tend to have very long training programs. This is in general the theory. So the theory is that Grad Plus and Stafford loans are very different. So Stafford loans are required by law to be deferred if you're in an in-school status. Grad Plus loans are not required to be deferred. So Grad Plus loans, theoretically, could be put into repayment after about a 60-day waiting period after taking them out. But the problem is your school reports your enrollment status to your servicer, which puts you automatically into in-school deferment on everything. And they do this potentially multiple times in a semester. And so effectively what's happening is there's no statutory requirement to say, hey, you cannot be on the save plan for grad plus loans. But the problem is like in practice, the way these very creaky ancient servicers operate is just constantly putting you back into in-school deferment. So what I'd be really interested in is if somebody wanted to take this all the way, I think there's actually potentially legs to this, and please reach out to help at studentloanplanner.com and share your experience if you do this, just so we could share this with other people if it works. But the idea behind it is, let's say you're a dental resident and you've got a bunch of loans from dental school. You ask for the in-school deferment waiver and you really press this all the way, right? You really take it all the way up the chain with your servicer, escalate it. If they still say no, file a CFPB complaint or file a student loan ombudsman complaint. You can find the student loan ombudsman FSA office by just Googling that. And then just say, you know, Stafford loans are required to be an in-school deferment, but grad plus loans are not. Therefore, I've asked for a waiver of in-school deferment on my grad plus loans that are eligible to enter repayment immediately, and I'd like to sign up for the save plan. And if you have $0 income, you're supposed to be able to get your interest subsidized. Now, this is something that the administration would absolutely hate because this is something that is very aggressive. It's very like extra beyond what the rules anticipated. And I say maybe it's not the administration that would hate it, but it's like definitely the career people at Department of Ed would really hate this because it goes against like what the law is like probably supposed to be. But what the law is supposed to be and what the law is are often different. And, you know, we've had very mixed experiences on this in the past. Back in the day before the pandemic, I would often tell people to attempt, especially dental residents, like in an ortho residency, you know, hey, go attempt to get your in-school deferment waiver granted, because dental residencies are like always like really unique, right? Because they're kind of like nobody really understands them. The servicers don't really understand them. The programs will just treat it like an in-school deferment and make it very difficult for you to get out of it. And that's like actively hurts you because you could be on this save plan getting subsidies. So it's sort of like, why would they fight it? But I think with the save plan being created, that this the incentive is much larger because it used to be that the repay plan was a 50% subsidy and only, well, on the interest your required payment didn't cover. 50% subsidy is not as good as 100% subsidy, of course. So if you could get 100% subsidy on what your required payment doesn't cover, and if you're a student with a $0 a month required payment because your income is zero or very low, there's no downside to trying this except a little bit of your time. You know, you might try to write in and request this first to save your pain and suffering from calling the phone lines for that Remember that poor person that was on hold for 3.5 hours? But then, you know, try to escalate it and just sort of say, hey, there's no statutory requirement for Grad Plus loans to be an in-school deferment, but there is for Stafford loans, so I'd like to enter save on my Grad Plus. And if this worked, then you could kind of get maybe a weighted average amount of like a couple to two and a half years of credit on the Grad Plus loans, maybe three. And then after you graduate, you can consolidate it all together and get weighted average credit from the period you were in school, which would be pretty cool. Because you could consolidate and maybe get that weighted average. You might get like 1 to 2 years worth of credit towards forgiveness if you were able to successfully do this. Now, again, this is a very challenging strategy because they might be kicking you back into in-school deferment like constantly. A lot of the servicers are just absolutely not going to want to do this. If you ask like a frontline person on the phones to do this for you, they're going to be like, no way. I'm busy trying to help people pay $200 instead of $1,000 because we can't calculate buttons. And you want to do this complicated in-school deferment waiver strategy? Oops, I dropped the phone call. Oops, my bad. Sorry. Right? I mean, that's like the old joke. Like a long time ago, I did a few weeks in a customer support center as part of like a training program. And that was like kind of the joke. It's like, you know, oh, oops, hung up. I mean, so in other words, if it's really hard, people are not going to want to do it because it hurts their like average time on the phone. It kind of makes all kinds of complex follow-up that they have to do. So the frontline person is really disincentivized to help you with this. So that's why I would send it in as a request to the contact center for the servicers, see what their response is. And you don't have anything to lose, right? Especially if you're just doing it online, you could just keep escalating it online. Maybe eventually call and put in a CFPB complaint and just say, you know, it's my understanding that we're allowed to request an in-school deferment waiver for Grad Plus loans exclusively that are not currently borrowed for that semester. That's the way I would say it. So in other words, Grad Plus loans borrowed for prior semesters, you know, you should be able to enter repayment at any time with those. We sometimes have to help people do this for like double consolidations with Parent Plus. Plus loans are a weird animal. There's definitely strategies, but sometimes these strategies just require a lot of effort and it just depends on how much it's worth it to you. But if you're saving $2,000 a month on payments 20 years from now, that's $24,000 in saved payments. And let's say you're going to go for refinancing, you know, and you're saving $2,000 a month of interest. You spend 5 hours with it. And if it's successful, let's say you save $20,000 with 5 hours worth of work. That's $4,000 an hour. Let's say it's only a 50-50 chance of working out. Well, that expected value of the wage there is $2,000 an hour. Would you do that? You know, maybe you're just sitting around watching like some Netflix holiday special and you just send this in, you know what I mean? So it's like, might as well try it. So really good questions from listeners. I'd love for you to ask your question. And to do that, you just have to go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. That's all you got to do. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. You press that record button. Maybe you pause the podcast and open it up right now in your browser so you remember to, you know, where to go to ask the questions. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. And then ask us a question because it's really fun to feature these on episodes and try to really just make the shows a little more fun and interesting. So I'm going to transition now to talking about some moves to make for student loans in 2024. So I think what's going to happen is at some point FSA is going to come up with a payment tracker, and that payment tracker is going to probably show a bunch of really incorrect information. So that's one point, is at some point you're going to find out what your forgiveness date is that's projected. And it's probably going to be horrifically wrong. That's what I would bet. Maybe not for everybody, but for some people, it's going to be horrifically wrong. So you're going to need to have a case built with your NSLDS as to like what your payment count should be. So that's down the road, but we're anticipating there's going to be a lot of demand for people that are going to need help with that, to build the case, to be like, here's my payment history, here's the amount of payments I made. It really helps them when somebody's really organized and can prove something. And so that's what we're thinking will happen a lot in 2024. Other things that are going to happen a lot in 2024 are people freaking out over the last second ability to sign up for the pay and the ICR plans. So the pay plans are really important for people that borrowed between 2007 and 2014, because those are the folks that can get pay but can't get new IBR. And so if you think about who became a new grad starting in 2007 to 2014, it's people that are like mid-30s to people that are like mid to late 20s. So that's like a pretty big group of people. If you fall into that category, it's a big deal, particularly if you make six figures. Because if you make six figures, the difference between 5 extra years of save payments and an extra $100 to $150 a month on the pay plan versus the save plan, that's like a way bigger you know, advantage to pay, usually, not always, but usually if you're making six figures or plan to make six figures and you're, you know, you're trying to decide between 20-year forgiveness with pay and 25-year forgiveness with save with slightly lower payments, getting it done sooner usually is much better. But there's a deadline. You've got to sign up for this, the pay plan, by July 2024. And we're seeing stuff where servicers are actively not caring to invest in the ability for people to sign up for the pay plan. In many cases, they're making it very difficult for people because they know it's going away. So why would they spend money on allowing people to do it? So this is going to be a big old mess in 2024. And we're looking forward to being able to help people navigate that. Another big thing people are going to deal with in 2024 is Parent Plus double consolidations. We've got a limited ticking clock for that to happen. And, you know, for paper applications, those things often take a while. The servicers are really trying to punch us in the face, too, because some of them, like, randomly change their addresses sometimes. And so we've even had some people's applications bounce back, unfortunately, in some cases because servicers are just changing stuff all around and putting different addresses out there. And the servicers are just crushing under the weight of all this. And Congress doesn't want to give them any money because Republicans very much see the Democrats as not an honest party in all of these things, where any more money for Department of Ed is going to be more forgiveness that they'll be able to process, which Republicans, you know, oppose. So I don't see, frankly, any, you know, ease of that logjam anytime soon. So servicers will keep having no money, no ability to hire call center staff. You know, I don't want to sound depressive on it, but it just sort of, you have to be realistic. So that means if you want to really make sure your double consolidation goes through, you know, frankly, I probably would not think that you should be really comfortable with any double consolidation that does not start at some point in 2024. If your double consolidation does not start in 2024, I would have a fairly cautious, you know, attitude about somebody being able to get double consolidated by the July 2025 deadline. So I think that we'll have a lot of Parent Plus people come out of the woodwork, frankly, for people that could really benefit enormously from this program, but unfortunately need to get moving on it. And there's some people too that need to go back to school. So a lot of people that have already consolidated their loans can go and sign up to be a part-time student somewhere and take out a little bit of loans in their own name. And then now they have loans they can consolidate with their Parent Plus. We call this the, quote, grandma goes back to school loophole, end quote. And that's a loophole that you've got to kind of sign up for fairly soon. You probably would, at the very latest, you'd need to sign up in the fall of 2024 and, you know, probably really strategically plan getting those loans and then not being a student anymore so that you can get all that consolidated in time. So that'll be a big thing. Another big thing will be administrative forbearance is ending. So we have this backdoor student loan pause extension going on right now. One thing I've said on this podcast a lot is Democrats absolutely run circles around Republicans in terms of like strategy with student loans and getting people as much forgiveness as possible. Literally, Republicans wrote into law a provision that said the student loan pause shall end on, you know, whatever they said, August 31st, I think it was. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. It shall end on this date. They literally wrote it in the law. And the Biden administration created this administrative forbearance regulation that basically said that, you know, a servicer can put you in administrative forbearance and it's supposed to count for IDR and for PSLF and such. In addition to that, because people were getting just really mass miscalculated payments on their loans, the Biden administration's response was to say, well, everybody's in administrative forbearance. So they basically told the servicers, hey, put everybody in administrative forbearance. And then they said, through the Higher Education Act power of cancellation, which is the whole theory that progressives have of, as to why the president can, with the flick of a pen, wipe out $1.7 trillion, that power is being claimed to waive interest during this period of administrative forbearance for people that have been placed into it. And that's basically the same thing as the student loan pause. So in other words, like Republicans tried to write a law that would prevent Biden from extending the student loan pause, and he's effectively done just that. It's brilliant, actually, if you think about it. And that student loan pause is not necessarily going to end uniformly for everyone. The administrative forbearance is probably going to end for some people in, at the end of December. Some people, it might even be a little longer, though. It might be January, it might be February or March. But in 2024, most people will be asked to make payments again. So most people will be drug into repayment again. And I think that what's going to happen is a lot of people are going to be totally unprepared for how they did their taxes. So people are going to look at their tax situation and they're going to say, oh, nuts. I should have filed separate and we're joint and my payment's like $2,000 a month instead of $500 a month. I got to get that fixed. Or people will look at filing separately and they'll say, oh my gosh, filing separate would cost us an extra 10 grand. Is there anything that we can do to, you know, ameliorate that, limit that damage? we think there's going to be a ton of people reaching out over that kind of stuff in 2024. And, you know, it's obviously a good idea to get ahead of that. So if you do know you've got some married filing separate questions, studentloanplanner.com/book is the place to go for that. We think that that'll be a big deal. We also think that there's going to be a new sort of front opened on the student loan forgiveness trench warfare, I guess, or I don't know, weird analogy, but basically people with only undergrad debt will be able to pay 5% of their income towards their save plan instead of 10. That goes into effect in July. So if you think about this math, let's pretend a nurse is making 80K a year, and let's say she's got two kids and a spouse that makes about 60 as a teacher, something like that. You know, in the past, that nurse probably needs to pay back her loans because there's no math that gets her forgiveness, right? So if she got a BSN, has $30,000 of debt, be a little difficult to get forgiveness on that. With the SAVE plan, the new deduction for a family size of 3, because remember, if you file separately, you can't count your spouse. So if she files separately, her family size deduction for SAVE would be about $55,000. So the difference between 80 and 55 is $25,000. And if you have to pay 10% of that, it's $2,500 a year. But if you have to pay 5% of that, it's about $1,250 a year. So $1,250 times 10 is about $12,000, $12,500, right? And that's way less than $30,000. But the issue now is this couple probably has their kids in daycare. And so one of the callers today talked about what happens with my dependent care FSA, the loss of that benefit. And so now you got to look at what are the tax implications of filing separately for this person? And is that damage minor compared to the savings on the loans, right? Because if you're losing $1,000 a year of tax credits every year for 10 years, yeah, it might help that your student loan payments are $12,000 and you get $30,000 forgiven, but $12,000 plus, you have to add the tax costs, right? Plus $10,000 of costs from doing the filing separately, from losing those tax credits. And then you probably also have to add extra marginal tax costs of having an expert manage it for you instead of doing it yourself. For example, if we're charging $99 a month for tax planning and prep, you know, maybe that's $1,000 a year too. So you're at 30K versus 30K, you're about at a break-even point. So one of our goals is to make sure that, like, if somebody's using our services for something, that it more than pays for itself if we're going to do something long-term. So for this nurse, I might say, well, if you max out your 401K, you get your taxable income down to a low enough number if you can afford that maximization where you're going to pay almost nothing on your student loans. And hey, now let's look at, you know, some other credits or some other opportunities where you might be able to not cost yourself as much money filing taxes separately. So maybe you can lower that cost. And then maybe, you know, in addition, if you're getting tax planning, you know, maybe you're getting some strategies that you're not even aware of that could actually pay for itself alone. So for an example of this would be a lot of people are itemizing these days. And a lot of that's because the mortgage interest levels are way higher. So if you look at your mortgage interest deduction, and this is a really big deal. If you look at, and if you want to find this on our calculator, you go to studentloanplanner.com and you just look at the calculators in the menu section and you'll find one that says doctoral mortgage calculator. And that's the same thing as a mortgage calculator, really. But if you put in, let's say, a $500,000 mortgage with a 20% down payment at 7%, that interest per year is about $28,000. But if you did a 3% mortgage, that interest deduction is only $12,000. So if you think about for a family, the standard deduction is about 26. So if you have about 13K of interest as a couple, you know, you probably are not itemizing, probably, because your interest is only, you know, it's 13, and maybe you pay some state and local property taxes that's 10. Then maybe you have like a couple thousand to a few thousand of charitable donations, and you're sort of at a wash of standard deduction versus itemizing. But you know, you could bunch charitable contributions, right? You could maybe donate all your charitable contributions in 1 year so that you could pass that standard deduction threshold so that you could itemize when you normally don't, and you could save thousands of dollars in taxes that way. You could also recognize that, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that I was able to itemize my mortgage like with such a high interest amount. And so maybe there's a lot of stuff you're not paying attention to that you could itemize that you're not aware of, like stuff like updates on your house, like, you know, energy efficiency stuff, like tax credits on your cars, like, yeah, you know, all kinds of stuff that people tend to not pay attention to, especially for business owners. This is usually pretty easy to find some enormous tax benefits. But there could also be other ways, right? Like maybe your spouse is a business owner or contractor and you're not, And so maybe there's ways to shift income from you to your spouse or vice versa to get you a lower IDR payment. That's something that we see all the time where, you know, somebody's paying their spouse who works at the practice, you know, some sort of like 10K wage, you know, instead, hey, maybe it makes sense to pay them more of a market wage because then maybe you could both max your 401ks out and maybe you could get below the magic number. I think it's something like 360K for getting the 20% write-off on business profits with the qualified business income deduction. So there's all kinds of stuff you can do. And I think what's going to happen in 2024 is just like this whole new world of people that previously were told, you know, go refinance your loans and pay $300 or $400 a month and pay them off in 10 years. Suddenly all that groups of folks suddenly has the option to go for forgiveness and get some serious forgiveness too, not just small amounts. And if you think about, you know, what's the benefit of saving 20 or 30 grand over a 10-year period of time? I mean, that's kind of like a car. If somebody wanted to give you a car and you had to fill out a little bit of paperwork once a year, people are probably going to do that. We're interested to see what are people's questions going to be on this, and will this be something people understand and want to do? And two, will the famous personal finance talking heads that always poo-poo forgiveness, will they be, you know, really against this, really pushing back hard? Hey, don't do this. This is a terrible idea. You know, and in some cases, it is a bad idea because you don't want to pay extra taxes plus student loan payments that are more than what you'd get if you just paid it off, right? That's not what we're in support of. We just like maths. We just like the maths. Look at the Excel spreadsheets. Look at the tax code. What can you save? That's as simple as what it really is. And in 2024, a sort of a business goal of ours is that we'd like to create a little bit more fun investing, financial freedom, ways to save money type content. And we might just make like a second like episode for that. You know, if you have any thoughts or suggestions, always feel free to reach us out, hit us up on social channels or comment sections or reply to our email and let us know what your thoughts are. But that's something I'd like to look into in 2024, because I think that, you know, if you think about what is the point of helping student loan borrowers, it's so that you grow wealth and reduce your stress and increase, you know, options in your life. So one way to do that is certainly to minimize the worry about your debt. But one of the reasons why we started, you know, doing financial planning is, you know, we want to help you on the asset side of the equation and on the freedom side of the equation too, and not just the don't worry about your debt part. But if you need a student loan plan, studentloanplanner.com/book, love to help you. Hopefully we'll have a lot of good content for you in the new year, and hopefully whatever comes our way in 2024, we'll be ready to help you out. Thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast.